Hi, this is Janelle Engelstad, and welcome to the MAP Radio Hour podcast, produced by Make Art with Purpose. The MAP Radio Hour features conversations with people addressing issues at the intersection of art, society, the environment, and culture. You can find out more about MAP and our projects at makeartwithpurpose.net. This episode of the MAP Radio Hour features a conversation with creative director and independent curator Aida Sulova. Born and raised in Kyrgyzstan, Sulova's wide-ranging critical and community practice extends from Central Asia to the U.S. The conversation begins with Sulova reflecting on news from Central Asia, a project and exhibition organized for the Jewelry Library in New York, where she invited Central Asian artists to create wearables that express political and social themes. The artwork and catalog for news from Central Asia can be viewed at thejewelrylibrary.com. Tell us a little bit about your practice, how you've come to produce projects both in the States and in Central Asia, where you're from, and if there's a bridge between that work and what that bridge is and how that informs you as a curatorial person and as a person really doing community-based practice.
Well, I was born in the Soviet Union, and the practice there is nothing like, you know, I'm having now. If you wanted to be a writer, you were supposed to go to, like, you know, literature school and graduate from university. If you wanted to be an artist, you were supposed to graduate from Surikov school, you know, go to a fine art academy. And you cannot just, you know, decide to become, you know, a writer or an artist, or, like, you really had to go through this academic, you know, process. And I was growing up thinking that I would never afford it, and I never went to an art school. Because I was thinking, you know, you really had to have a permission, sort of like a diploma from the state to become one. And then, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed, but I always, you know, felt creative and artistic, but I never went to school. So I decided that I'll just work as, you know, whatever I get. And I've been working as an executive assistant for quite, you know, a while. And then I had this workshop with Kendall Henry. He's actually based here in New York City. So they, you know, came to Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, and they just announced that there's going to be some creative workshop. And at that point of time, I didn't even know what workshop is. Like, that word was just out of my vocabulary. It was something new. And I took, you know, 2-week vacation from my secretarial job, and I came to that workshop. And then I saw the presentation about public art and what it is and what it stands for. And together with Kendall and other folks, we turned an abandoned bus into a theater. And that changed my life. I just started crying because I felt like, well, this is me. That's what I want to do. And the new thing for me was that you really don't need the permission. You don't need a diploma, you know, to practice what you want, what you really love. And so I really like the fact that what you do with, like, even that bus can actually, you know, change your life and the life of communities. And that's how I started doing, you know, what I'm doing now. And so also I won a scholarship sponsored by George Soros Open Society Foundation. Mm-hmm. You know, it was also right after the fall of the Soviet Union. And then also, you know, I graduated from high school, and then I got accepted at the local university, but I've been also trying to apply, you know, to different kinds of programs just to travel, to see the world and to study abroad. And I got accepted and I got a scholarship, and I came to United States in 1999, and I studied at Rutgers, and I studied political science because I was thinking that I may have to, like, work as a politician and, you know, and have my, like, women party. But at Rutgers, I happened to stay at Demarest dormitory, which was full of visual arts students, and, you know, hanging out with them and, you know, talking a lot about art, freedom, democracy. That also made me think that maybe not politics, maybe, you know, arts would be better to study.
Right. But what you've managed to do is weave the political and the artistic practice together, something very close to my heart. And this is relevant in this show you've just curated at the Jewelry Library in New York and throughout your practice. So why don't we jump ahead and tell us a little bit about this exhibition that you've just curated. It's Jewelry Week right now in New York City. And I think what's interesting about this exhibition that you've put together is I think a lot of people, and even people in the arts, might necessarily think of jewelry as a political act, as supplying a political voice, a voice of protest, although there are certainly examples of it throughout history. But this was very specific in its intention to capture voices from Central Asia and talk about what's going on there for people culturally, politically, socially, and through a rich tapestry of different jewelry pieces.
I was thinking that there are so many beautiful, you know, cool things here in New York City. And for me, bringing, you know, same beautiful, you know, gorgeous things here from Central Asia, that would be nice. But I thought that this is like a, you know, lifetime opportunity to bring all Central Asian artists here and their work and show what it feels like to live there and what's the political agenda and temperature. And it's just, I created, you know, different kinds of contemporary art shows, you know, about Russian occupation of Georgia and, you know, about the protests, about the different issues back in Bishkek. And this is my first show like of this scale in New York City. And I just wanted also to kind of decolonize the visual language and visual representation of Central Asia. And so it also felt like an experiment because I didn't really know what to expect from the viewers, from the public. But I heard really, really interesting comments that like everything here resonates with them. And it doesn't really, you know, specify that it's only Central Asian, you know, set of issues. Because we have, you know, work about protests, about environmental issues, about decolonization or restoration of culture. And so many people found that the work is actually something that relates to their lives as well, the people from New York City. That's something that I wanted to kind of, you know, bring here to the United States, that the art, it's a common universal visual language. So it was also really important to me that I don't represent Central Asia as a periphery or as, you know, as a third world, you know, area. I wanted that kind of a level just to show that visual language is universal, doesn't have a hierarchy. And there are so many ways to protest, even like to educate yourself as a form of protest, I would say. And so many mediums, like even, you know, objects or clothing or costumes, jewelry, these are all medium to express your emotions, issues, and shed light on different issues here.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting to think about all the different ways of protest and that education can be a form of protest. I think that's something we don't often think about in the States or maybe in the West as much. If I'm thinking back to the Soviet Union in the Eastern Bloc pre-1989, before the fall of the Berlin Wall, educating oneself really was a form of protest.
Yes, and I really like how the artist responded to, you know, my initial concept about representing the news in the form of an art object, a wearable object, because many of them, they were thinking about their past to, you know, to reflect the future, the present and the future. That reflection was not about, you know, nostalgia or about some regrets. It was more about, you know, just looking back and clearly like understanding what happened, you know, and just find answers to questions like who they are today. Like I have a big, you know, project represented here by the artist from Kazakhstan, and it's about Uyghur culture. And it's just interesting how the artist is stating that everybody is just so busy with politics, but nobody is really into, you know, restoring and studying the culture a forgotten culture of Uyghur people. And so, many other examples of how artists responded in like so many really sometimes unexpected ways.
You actually traveled back home for the first time since the pandemic, I believe, to work on this exhibition. Mm-hmm. What surprised you when you got there? What did you find changes? How long had it been since you'd been there previously? And tell us a little bit about what's going on there now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't been home for 3 years. Yeah. And when I went back to visit my family and also to work on this exhibition, it felt differently. It felt like I have a bigger picture, you know, after being away for so long. I realized that there are so many people that are so interesting and, you know, they should have a chance to kind of, you know, be heard and understood and represented. And that's why every time I met with the artists, it was also very emotional because I could feel the hunger. Yeah, every conversation was very intense and very emotional. And also talking about the concept, the most interesting part was that I realized there is also a hierarchy. There's like a, you know, contemporary art, which is like high art, and anything wearable was for some reason considered as craft, you know, arts and crafts, stuff you get on Etsy, you know. And for some artists, it was a big challenge because they're like, but I make, you know, drawings and paintings and installations, but never jewelry, because for some jewelry is like just, you know, a costume, like a bijou or something. And some of them made the jewelry for the first time and really enjoyed it. And now they look at it differently.
There still seems to be a shadow from communism. And this shadow exists in various degrees throughout the former Soviet system and the satellite countries. Do you still sense that there when you were just there recently working on this exhibition? Do you still see these threads or this sort of hangover, sometimes I call it, from the Soviet system, that the country is still emerging from this?
Yes, absolutely. It's actually, you know, one of the works is about that particular question. It's called Perestroika and Collapsible Perestroika, the name of the necklace. And it's a work of this, you know, really, really famous artist, Shailo Jakshinbaev. So he's known for his work on construction and deconstruction. And it's a photo of the broken asphalt where a person is jumping from like one broken piece onto another. And so the idea is that Perestroika, it's not an overnight event. It's not just, you know, that the new government came and everything has changed. No, in a way we are still in that, you know, Perestroika moment, in that phase of eternal transformation. Nobody really knows how to deal with independence, with the freedom, you know, because for so many years of, you know, having this a socialist regime, you know, it just doesn't really go away just immediately. There are so many, you know, traits and so many, like even habits that people are still having and they cannot really, you know, forget about them. And you can clearly see in some of the works here how people use some objects from the household that they had during the life in the Soviet Union. And they look at these household items. They don't really hate them, but they just, you know, they look at these objects differently. And they're trying to understand that they're trying to portray this object as a bearer of the information, of cultural code, of, you know, as like reminders of the different, like even tragic events that happened in history.
So tell us a little bit about the art center you founded and how that operates and what kind of catalyst that is in the community.
That was a project of my life, actually. It was a big one. I dedicated a lot of time and energy and love to this project because I believe that an art center of that sort can actually enhance and help strengthen democracy. And I strongly believe in the fact that, you know, the more diverse the voices, all kinds of voices in artistic area, you know, the better for democracy. And so that opportunity came unexpectedly. I've been working on the project called American University of Central Asia. It's a new campus designed by Henry Meyerberg and his firm, and I work for him. So he invited me to join his team and work on graphics, design, and public art. And I traveled back home and worked on this project. And we've invited 25 artists, and they produced different kinds of art pieces for the campus. So, and I've been, you know, sharing it with on social media, and there were a lot of events and exhibitions and talks. And so the local businessmen in Kyrgyzstan, they saw it and they invited me to look at the space they had, because they were thinking they wanted, you know, a brewery, like a place where people would drink beer and dance. And they wanted my advice how to make it, you know, interesting. And my proposal was to turn this place into a community kind of resource place where people could also drink and dance, not only drink and dance, but also like have, you know, events or exhibitions or, you know, seminars, all kinds of, you know, activities. And they liked the proposal, and I used different examples of different, you know, art centers around the world. And I showed the financial model and how people can actually come and what would engage them. And it worked, and they just started building it. And then I've been, you know, at the construction side of it all the time, and the construction workers became my family. And during the construction, I've invited the orchestra, the real youth orchestra of students, you know, from the music school. They came, it was a big one, and they gave a live performance for construction workers. And for many construction workers, that was the first time in their lives that they saw, you know, a music performance of that sort. And that's how I just started letting the life in the center in, and the whole process became, it's like a performance. You know, I've invited different photographers to make, you know, a series of photos of the construction. And I just kept sharing so that the city becomes, you know, a participant in this process and in the creation. And then by the time I finished the construction, everybody knew about the project, and I didn't really have to spend money on promotion, on advertising. And for me, it was like, I just make one post on Facebook and I would, you know, have like 300 people come to the event. And I really enjoyed it. So my original idea was that it's a community resource center for everyone and for people to come, enjoy, and enrich their cultural life. But I also thought that that could also be, you know, a place where you could come and share your concern. I know, I just really wanted that place to be not just as an entertainment, but also a place where you can learn and also share. And so that's why I started curating shows like, you know, about Georgian occupation, about, you know, Ukraine. Yeah, that's how it went. And after 2 years of working very hard, there was a team of other creatives and people, so they continued, and I came back to the United States.
The MAP Radio Hour is produced by Make Art with Purpose and edited by Matthew Horton. Theme song by Jan Vorpas. Logo by Otto Huditz. I'm Janiel Ingolstadt. Thanks for listening, and visit makeartwithpurpose.net to learn more about our projects and connect with us on social media.